I don't know how long it's been since you had to hunt for a job. But, you know, when you're out of work and you're looking for work, it really is, I was going to say it can be, but there's no maybe about it. It's a stressful time. When you need a job, and even when you got a line on something and you made the call or you filled out the application or you go to the interview and all that stuff. And after all that, though, comes the really hard part. The waiting. I put in the paperwork, I filled out the forms, I sat through an interview and it seemed to go okay. I think they like me, kind of a thing. And then you wait. I think Tom Petty had it right when he said, "The waiting is the hardest part." We'll take that off the tape. The Tom Petty impression doesn't belong. But you get the idea. You're waiting. When the phone rings, is that them? No, it's not. It's just you, The mail comes. Oh, I saw the mail carrier go out and get the mail. And you're sorting through on this bill, junk mail. No letter. No letter that says, we're pleased to inform you that, or even the letter that says, we're sorry to inform you, but you don't know. And you're just waiting and you're waiting. And man, it just gets really tough. And then finally, praise the Lord, whether it's a phone call or a letter or a meeting or whatever, you find out, you get the news, you got the job. The job is yours. You are now employed, which means a lot of stuff. It means you have somewhere to go. It means you're earning money, which is probably the most important part of almost every job there is. And then the waiting's over, but then there's this really weird period. I don't know what, there's no name for it. It's the in-between period. You know what I'm talking about? Because you have the job, but you haven't started working yet. You've been hired, so you're not looking for a job anymore. No more resumes, no more interviews, but you still have yet, it's a few days or a week or whatever until that start date when you go down and start the job. And it's kind of an awkward time, but man, it's such a relief. I got the job. No more stress. No more, sleepless nights, tossing and turning. Oh, what am I going to do? I got the job. In fact, you might even do what my son did the last time he got a job. He hadn't started working yet, but he went right out and bought a new pair of shoes. It's a big deal these days. I mean, shoes are like $100. You haven't started working yet, but you're so confident. You're feeling so good about, I have a job. My name is on somebody's list, and I'm going to go to work, and so I have the assurance of an income, and I can go out and spend, 20, 40, $100 on a pair of shoes. That's a pretty cool time, And as believers and disciples of Jesus, we find ourselves now in that strange in-between time. We are saved, we are redeemed, we're set free, we're all of that stuff, but we haven't entered into the ultimate reality of it yet. It's like we got the job, but we haven't started working. We're in that in-between part. We have the assurance of salvation, and that gives us then the confidence to live as saved people while we wait for the fulfillment, the ultimate fulfillment of what salvation is really about. And what we're talking about is the difference that hope makes. The difference that hope for the future makes in the present. And as we work through these verses in Romans chapter 8, we're going to see that hope does make a difference. So let's read these verses, starting in Romans 8, verse 18. We're just going to read down through verse 22. Now, it's funny, verse 18 kind of explains verse 17, so we can back up to 17. But verse 17, at least in the New King James, starts with the word "and." It's not just the middle of an idea, it's literally the middle of a sentence. So now you got to back up to verse 16, which is in the middle of a thought, but at least it's a better place to start than an "and." So verse 16, "The Spirit himself," this is where we left off last Sunday, "The Spirit himself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God. And if children, then heirs, heirs of God and joint heirs with Christ, if indeed or since we suffer with him, that we may also be glorified together." Now note the last part of that. "If indeed we suffer with him, that we may also be glorified together. Now he explains that a little bit. For I consider the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. And now he explains that. For the earnest expectation of the creation eagerly waits for the revealing of the sons of God. And now he, yet another kind of a nested idea here. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope. Because, and now just kind of a technical note, verse 21 here actually picks up on the idea of verse 19. Verse 20 is almost a parenthetical. Because, well, back up to 19. For the earnest expectation of the creation eagerly waits for the revealing of the sons of God. Now verse 21. Because the creation itself also will be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation groans and labors with birth pangs together until now. That's where we'll leave off for today. Now, before we get into the difference that hope makes, we need to have an understanding, first of all, of what hope is. And a lot of times for us, I think we use the words hope and wish interchangeably. But they're not at all the same thing. You know, hoping is not wishing. Wishing has to do with something that may, but most likely won't come to pass. You know, I wish I could win the lottery. Now, I don't even buy lottery tickets, so the odds are slightly more against me than they are against the people who do buy them, you know. But I wish I could win the lottery, but it's more than likely not going to happen, even if I do buy a ticket. I wish the weather in Tootle were nice every day. Don't you wish that? But, you know, probably not going to happen. These are things that they may happen, but most likely won't happen. Now, a hope, on the other hand, has been defined as a confident expectation. And that's a lot different than a wish. You know, I hope the Lord comes soon. Now, that's not just a wish. I know the Lord's coming soon. I don't know exactly when, but I know he's coming. And I hope it's soon. I'm ready. Every time a car backfires going up and down our road, I go, is that it, Lord? Is that, you know, I expect to float up through the ceiling in this thin, lithe body that I hope, I confidently expect to inherit, you know. That's the difference. You know, I hope we have a great potluck tonight. And I say that because I'm pretty sure we will. We always do. We haven't had a bad one yet. Nothing going on tonight that would spoil anything. So I hope that. That's the difference. These are things that are expected to happen. Now, in the passage here, the word hope in English is the Greek word elpis. It's like, that's not Spanish either, you know. Elpis. It's not, it just sounds like that, but it literally means to anticipate, usually with the idea of anticipation of something good, something pleasurable, like a season, you know, looking forward, anticipating spring, anticipating summer, when the water gets warm enough to go down and jump in the river and swim and do barbecues and have all that fun stuff. I hope to be around for my next birthday. I wish someone would give me $1 billion. Probably not going to happen, but I pretty much expect, you know, Lord willing, and if he wants to take me, I'm ready to go, but I kind of expect that I'm stuck here for another birthday or two or five or something, you know. That's the difference between a hope and a wish. Now, wishing can be fun. We all know that, you know, dreaming of things and imagining things. I still dream about what I'm going to be when I grow up. And it's way too late for any of that stuff. You know, I'm not going to be an astronaut. Just not going to happen. I'm not going to be an athlete. I'm not, you know, of any kind. I'm not going to be successful in the music business, which was my goal at one time. But dreaming about those things, imagining those things. But see, wishing doesn't really affect our actions or our attitudes. Now, hope, on the other hand, makes a huge difference in the way that we live. Now, the first thing we learn about hope in this passage is that hope makes a difference as we struggle with sin. As we're here in this in-between period, we are saved. It's, the theologians have called it a already but not yet. I'm already saved. We already belong to God. Our future, our eternity is secure. It's fixed because of faith in Jesus Christ and what he did for us. But we're not there yet. It's already but not yet. And while we're here, we still have, as long as we live in these lumpy bodies of flesh, some more lumpy than others, you know, but we will struggle with sin. Look at verse 18 again. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. Now note that last part, in us. We're going to come back to that, but it's not revealed to us. It's not revealed for us. It's revealed in us. Now everybody, everywhere, experiences some kind of suffering in their life. That's part of life on planet Earth. But there's one kind of suffering that is unique to believers, and that is the suffering that comes from struggling with sin. See, the unsaved people don't have any struggle with sin. They don't recognize sin as sin. Just going for it is kind of everyday normal behavior, and there's not really any other expectation. There's no other hope about it. But for a believer in Jesus Christ, that is one who is profoundly aware of the righteousness of God and acutely aware of our own sinfulness. Well, the struggle to be holy, and I probably have to explain that, not holier than thou, not perfect, not goody two-shoes. That stereotype is why people stay away from church. Well, if I get a part of the church, I'll have to either pretend to be good or I'll have to actually do something different. Well, wait a minute. It's just that we recognize God's goodness, God's grace, the idea that he loves and accepts us just the way we are. We come to him and confess our sin and agree with God, like they talked about yesterday at the conference, hama legeo, you know, same word. I say, yeah, Lord, I'm just innately wicked. I'm selfish. I'll tell a lie, boom, quicker than I'll blink my eyes. I'll cheat if I need to. If I need to pass the test or save some money on my taxes, that's just the way it is, and that's just the way we are, and it really is. And we compare that to the reality of God's perfect sinlessness, and man, it can bum you out, to say the least. But here we are, these believers, and we're acutely aware of that difference, and it's hard to live this set-apart life, which is what we're called to. The word sanctified is usually used. We're called to live a life that's different from the lives of people who don't know the Lord. It doesn't make us better. What's that bumper sticker? Christians aren't perfect. They're just forgiven. That's really it. I know a lot of unsaved people that are better people than a lot of the Christians I know, myself included. And the difference isn't who's better. It's who's forgiven, who's trusting the Lord for that reality. And see, that struggle of knowing what our eternity is going to be like, knowing what we have to look forward to, and then confronting the reality of who we are and what life here now is like, man, that leads to a kind of suffering that the lost world can never know. Even for the natural world, that is the creation, talking about the Seven Wonders Creation Museum. His point here is that even the natural world around us hopes, in a sense. I don't know if a tree can hope. But what he tells us here, for the earnest expectation of the creation eagerly waits for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, that is, you know, vanity, to worthlessness, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope, because the creation itself also will be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the gracious liberty of the children of God. Man, when you take a walk on a spring day around here, you go down by the river or just, you know, across the street, and you get about 100 yards off the highway, and you're in paradise, man. You're in the evergreen forest of Southwest Washington, and it's just as beautiful as it gets. You know, the tropical jungles may be different, but they're not nicer. I mean, you just look around, and I was watching eagles fly in my backyard the other day. Oh, it doesn't get any better than that. I'm trying to hope they don't come down and pick up my little dog and fly away with him. You know, here I have this nightmare. But it's just beautiful out there, you know. And we got rivers and streams and trees and wild animals. I got elk in the backyard and deer. And I saw the back end of a cougar hop over a fence a while back. You know, a lot of people don't get that. And you just go, wow, this place is awesome. This place is incredible. But compared to its original design and its future, this is like living in the city dump. That's the disparity between what is and what will be. And even the creation itself, you know, looks forward. And there's three things about this. Notice in verse 19, for the earnest expectation of the creation waits. What does it wait for? What is this created order waiting for? It's waiting for the revealing of the sons of God. It's waiting for us. That's who it's waiting for. Creation waits for us. It says this eager expectation. Now, that's not the same word translated hope. It's close, but this word eager, or these words eager expectation, it's kind of a picture word, and it means to watch with a stretched out neck. You know, you get the idea. What is that? You know, that's the creation, even the natural world here, is anticipating our ultimate deliverance. Verse 20, the second thing, for the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope. Creation was subjected because of us, not willingly. The creation didn't sin. It wasn't by the sweat of your brow you will grow thorns and thistles and eke out a living. No, in the beginning, in the Garden of Eden, man didn't have to weed the garden or plant anything or worry about irrigation or even a harvest. You just kind of walked around and go, oh, that looks good. I'll have one of those. And then, you know, next thing you get your arms full of watermelons and guavas and mangoes. And, you know, it's like everything you need. You got it right there. But because of us, it was subjected to this thing that we see now. Turn back to Genesis chapter 3. Talk about in the beginning. Now, you Bible students are going to recognize right off the first couple chapters. Chapter 1 is an overview of creation. Chapter 2 is a more detailed description of creation. And chapter 3 now, we have the temptation and fall of man, which is followed by God's pronouncement on what happens when you choose to go your own way rather than just trust me. And let's just focus on a couple of verses here. 3:17. Genesis 3:17. Then he said to Adam, because you've heeded the voice of your wife and have eaten from the tree of which I commanded you. Now, fellas, this is not a teaching on never listen to your wife. I know you'd love to believe that, but that's just not the whole context. But because you did this thing, what he should have done was said, honey, don't touch that. God told me we can have anything in all of creation but that one thing for our own protection we're to stay away from. But instead, she said, I'm going to have some of that. And he went, well, me too. Thanks a lot, doofus. Now we're all messed up. Anyway, you have heeded the voice of your wife and have eaten from the tree of which I commanded you, saying, you shall not eat of it. And so because of all that, cursed is the ground for your sake, because of you. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life, but thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the herb of the field. In the sweat of your face you shall eat bread, till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken. For dust you are, and to dust you shall return. And that's just the way it is, isn't it? You just break your back all day, every day, from the time you're old enough to break loose from your parents, and then ultimately you breathe your last, and they just plant you back in the same old dirt. And, you know, Solomon is the one who said, you know, vanity, vanity. It's all just, all of this life is just spinning your wheels. You know, you realize Solomon had everything. Son of David. Solomon had it all. He was the richest person. I mean, it says he had, I don't know how many thousands of horses, but that's kind of code for he had it all. I mean, if you've got 10,000 horses, that means how many barns do you have to have? And how many people do you have shoveling those barns? And how much hay do you have to buy? And it's like a whole, you know, agricultural structure that exists to support 50,000 or 100,000 horses. And he had a harem. Not a smart thing. In fact, that really is what messed Solomon up. You know, he wasn't supposed to intermarry with these foreign women, but he just, he gave in to that thing that guys have where it's, you know, I can't make love to every woman I see, but I'm going to try. And because he was the king, he gave it a heck of a try. He had 1,000 wives. And then who know how many girlfriends, you know, on the side. And at the end of his life, oh, not only that, not only rich, not only, you know, a harem, but he had that supernatural gift of wisdom given by God himself. I mean, he's the one who, you know, should we cut the baby in two? And Solomon said, well, just, go ahead and cut him in two. And then when they raised their sword, he saw which woman said, no, don't, you know, let the other one have him. He said, well, that's the mom. That's God-given wisdom right there. Wrote the book of Proverbs. And in Ecclesiastes, what does he say? All of that is baloney. Riches, providing for every desire of the flesh. You're just spinning your wheels, wasting your time. And here we are talking about the creation, you know, where because of that original sin, you got to break your back and toil and sweat just to scratch out a living. And then at the end of your time, you go back into the ground. And it's like, it's all just a big waste of time. Vanity, vanity. Everything is vanity. If there's no reconnection with your Creator, it's like we said a couple weeks ago, without a connection with the Lord, we're just dead men and women walking. And it really is that way. You know, that breaks my heart. Every once in a while, we'll do a funeral or something like that here, and it'll be some kind of tragic situation. Well, it's always tragic when someone, you know, loses their life and the family grieves. But there are some situations that are kind of more tragic than others because they're just, it's such a waste. And you look at the people who come in to say goodbye, and these aren't people that know the Lord or care about the Lord. They're, you know, they're apathetic, if not in outright rejection of the Lord. And you just look around the room, and you're not, it's not a judgmental, you know, thou art a sinner. No, man, it's a broken heart going, you guys are just dead. You're in your 20s, you're in your 30s, you're in your 50s, whatever, you're in your 90s, you know, but you've never been alive. Oh, what a heartbreak that is. And you just want to say, please, please, just turn your heart to the Lord. He's done all that needs to be done to give you that sense of purpose that you ever wanted. And now the whole creation, because of our sin, was subjected to the curse. And that's why there are earthquakes and tidal waves and floods and hurricanes and tornadoes and volcanoes. You know, that's not part of God's created perfect order. Death and destruction, so-called acts of God, the insurance companies blaming God for that nonsense. Don't blame God, blame sin. And so this whole world, you know, it was subjected because of us, verse 20 says. It's waiting for us, verse 19 says, but then verse 21, because the creation itself also will be, future tense, delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. Creation will be liberated because of us. And that's what we have to look forward to. And the really cool part about that looking forward is that God isn't just going to fix this place. I mean, that would be cool, wouldn't it? No more so-called natural disasters. No more. Every summer, some poor soul jumps in the water and doesn't come back up. And we read their name in the paper. And then we have another funeral. All they did was go swimming. They jumped off the bridge or something, or they got tired or had a cramp. I mean, who knows? But these kind of disasters, it just wouldn't be part of God's creation if he fixed it. But he's not going to fix it. He's going to remake the whole thing. He's going to destroy this planet, and he's going to create a new earth and a new heaven, even better than the one that we look back on in those early chapters of Genesis. And then I wonder what the debate will be about creation evolution. Although it'll only be believers there, but I don't know, are we going to stand up and kind of watch, you know, the second Big Bang, only this one, no question what its source is? Anyway, even the natural world, I think that's incredible. You know, while we're waiting, there's this hope, this confident assurance that there's a future ahead of us that is beyond our wildest imaginations. We're already in the kingdom, but one day there won't be anything but the kingdom. And this battle, this tug of war between my flesh and my spirit won't exist anymore. The spirit will win, and that's just the way it'll be. Verse 22, for we know that the whole creation, and that would include not only the earth, but the moon and the sun and the stars and everything that is everywhere, the whole creation groans and labors with birth pangs together until now. The whole creation. I don't know about you, but I want so badly to please the Lord. I want to hear, well done, good and faithful servant. And I want the inner satisfaction of knowing that I have served the one who gave his life to save me. Whether that's big ways or little ways, you don't have to be the pastor of a church or in ministry. Just, you know, you can be a carpenter and serve the Lord. You can be an auto mechanic and serve the Lord. And man, I want so badly to please him. And not because I'm afraid he'll stop loving me. Oh, that's it. You're cut off. You know, I gave you 10 chances or 300 chances, and number 301, you know, there's no straw that breaks the camel's back when it comes to God. So it's not that. It's not that I'm afraid he'll stop loving me, but it's because his grace has so captured my heart. And there is within me a debt of love and gratitude that makes me want to please him in every way. And every day, I miss that mark. Every hour, I miss that mark. I fall short, not only of the glory of God, but of my own expectations and my own desires. And that bums me out totally. But it doesn't have to be that way. It doesn't have to be that way in its hope. It's the confident expectation and anticipation of my ultimate deliverance from sin and the struggle with sin that makes the difference. And he uses here in verse 22 the best example from human experience there could ever be. We know that the whole creation groans with birth pangs together until now. And every mom says, amen. Birth pangs. You don't have to turn there, but this is what it says in John chapter 16, verse 21. Jesus said this: a woman, when she's in labor, has sorrow because her hour has come. But as soon as she's given birth to the child, she no longer remembers the anguish for joy that a human being has been born into the world. Now, every mom knows that, and to a degree, a whole lot of dads know that. I remember for our first child, it was one of those old traditional where you waited in the father's waiting room with all the men, you know, smoking in the hospital. And you can't, that sounds so weird now, but that's just the way it was back in the olden days. And then the nurse brings you this kind of crusty, blue, curdled up little thing and says, this is your new son. And you go, oh, you know, I don't know. But the second one, when Rachel was born, we had a weird deal. She was born at home on purpose. It wasn't one of those emergencies where we couldn't make it. We actually planned this thing out. And the doctor was there And it was a beautiful experience. But I don't know what the labor was. I don't remember. It was, you know, 10, 12 hours. It was a while. Not as long as some, but this is the second child. So anyway, and, you know, I don't know how you gals do it. Because I didn't, like I said, I wasn't there for the first one. So this was a new experience for me. And I remember Carol Burnett once on TV saying, if you guys want to know what it's like to have a baby, just take your bottom lip and pull it up over your forehead. And then maybe you'll know. I'm not going to try that. I went to the emergency room once with what turned out to be kidney stones. And remember the ER doctor saying, well, yeah, that's the closest pain a man will ever know to giving birth, you know. And I, you know, threw my tears and, I can't believe it. It can be that bad. And you just, you know, the whole Lamaze thing, pa, 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 you know, stop breathing, you know, it's okay. Push, don't push, okay. You know, and you just get this thing out of me, you know, is probably the bottom line of the whole deal. And then it's just hours go on and, oh, I can see the head. Oh, this is awesome. And then get that shoulder out. And then the whole thing just kind of slips out. And in that instant, the joy of that miracle eclipses the last 24 hours of labor pains and the last, you know, 9 months of walking like this. And, you know, and if, God forbid, you be pregnant in the summer, you know, because that's just the worst. And that's what he's saying here, you know, this creation. Man, things are rough. I can't take it. I'm freaked out. I'm stressed out. Yeah, I know I belong to God. I know he loves me. But man, this is harder than I want it to be. And this is more frustrating than I want to be. And my friends, they used to be my friends, but now they make fun of me because I'm a Bible thumper. I'm a Jesus freak. And they just don't get it. And they don't invite me over to the Super Bowl party anymore like I'm going to get up on the footstool and preach a bunch of thou shalt nots. You know, and it's just all this stuff, and you go, God, you know, it's like, just get us out of here, and then will come that time when we kind of, we slip into the eternity, and we're going to go, struggle, what struggle? Pain, what pain? Frustration? I don't remember any of that. This is just so cool. I had no idea. Just like when that little one, and you said, I had no idea when our daughter gave birth to not our first grandchild, but her first child. I never forget it. Gave her the baby, you know, for the first time. And she looks down at this little guy and she says, I've been waiting my whole life for you. Well, Dad, I got to step out for a minute. You know. But now just think of your Heavenly Father. And we kind of, you know, we struggle and fight and painful and and finally, boom, we're there. And the Lord looks at you and he says, I've been waiting your whole life for you. And that's how this world we live in is, whether it's the society we live in, American culture, you know, sex saturated, people falling in and out. They think they're falling in and out of love. They're falling in and out of bed. And we don't believe in polygamy unless it's serial polygamy. You know, I've been married 10 times, but only one at a time, so that's okay. Well, no, it's not. It's not. I read something in the Daily News. Did you see this? I'm on a tangent, but this, I'll stop in a minute. I'm reading in the Daily News, and some guy wrote a letter, and he says, well, my fiance broke the news to me the other day that she's slept with over 100 men. And she's like, what, 22 or something, you know, this young girl. And it's not an outrage. It's a tragedy. Should I marry her anyway? Well, you know, I don't know that history really should be the deciding factor, but what does that say about her? This is someone who is so desperate for love that she'll share herself in a way that is meant to be sacred, just casually, like it doesn't matter. And that's the world we live in. And we look around this world, and not to judge it, but to recognize the tragedy of it and the political mess that's going on. And, you know, don't even want to get started in that direction. And there's a lot of reasons. There's a lot of things you can look, you know, the whole Afghanistan, Iraq, you know, war and Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and Muslim women who, if they get raped, they get killed because it's against the law to have sex outside of marriage. And you know, I'm thinking, where are all the women's rights that are going to stand up in outrage against that? But oh no, because, you know, we back our guy. And, you know, and you just kind of go, what's, things are screwed up. Not just politically, not just culturally, but literally, physically. I mean, there aren't supposed to be tidal waves that wipe out a quarter of a million people and earthquakes that, you know, it's just not supposed to happen. It's not part of God's intended creation, but one of these days, we're going to step through the other side of this, and all of this suffering, all of this frustration, all this rage is just going to give way to a joy. And the hope of that joy is what sustains us through all this turmoil and all this stress and all this frustration. See, there's a very real danger that our desire for holiness, for a set-apart life, that's all that means, for a life that's set apart from the world to God, the danger is that that desire to live that kind of life, to have that kind of life, can lead to frustration, and it can steal our hope. Oh, there's just this, you know, I give up. But don't let it steal your hope. See, when that happens, when that frustration level builds, and you just think, I can't take it anymore, I don't think God's listening. I don't think God's watching. In fact, I'm wondering if God is anything, because this is so messed up. When it gets close to that point, first of all, you just got to remember that our hope is in the Lord, not in ourselves. Now, if you want to campaign and if you want to take part in the system, God bless you, go for it. We have that privilege in this country where most don't. But just remember that we're not going to fix this thing. You know, this whole gay marriage thing is a hot topic politically these days, and different states are voting different ways, and then they vote again and they turn it over, and then the politicians, the courts turn that over, and it just, man, you know, what's going on? But we're never going to fix it. It's never going to be fixed. I've read the end of the book. It says, in the days of Noah, so shall it be. And then so you go back, what was it like in the days of Noah? Well, every man did what seemed right in his own eyes. There's a headline. Just remember that our hope is in the Lord, not in ourselves. And secondly, remember that the glory that will be revealed can't even compare with our present sufferings. A couple of passages you might want to take note of and meditate on these later. 1 Corinthians 2:9. No eye has seen. This is one of God's greatest hits. Everybody knows this one. No eye has seen, no ear has heard, no mind has conceived what God has prepared for those who love him. You can't even imagine what God has prepared. And in Ephesians 1:18, in the opening chapter, Paul writes, I pray also that the eyes of your heart may be enlightened in order that you may know the hope to which he has called you, the riches of his glorious inheritance in the saints. Now, I ended last week by using an example of the two circles. If you remember that, you're good to go. And if not, I'll try to catch up without repeating the whole thing. Two circles, just imaginary circles. Think of them as spheres, maybe, is even better. 3D now. And they are states of existence, you know, ways of living, not so much in what you do, but just kind of the condition that you're in. One circle had a big D on it, it stood for death. The other circle had a big L that stood for life. On the death side is addiction and divorce and legal disputes, custody disputes or property disputes and lawsuits, and you know, stole from me and I want this much from you, this litigious idea of also part of our modern American culture. It's death. It's living death. It's looking for love in all the wrong places. Now, the looking for love, that comes from God, but the wrong places, that comes from the enemy. And so there's this way of living that is really just death. And then on the other one, there's the life. And that is an existence that is based here and now on this hope that we just read about, the hope of the riches and glory that are going to be revealed in us, not just to us, but in us. And it's no longer living selfishly. I think the way I said it last week was we're free at last from this subjective selfishness where everything that we experience is filtered through the lens of how's that going to affect me? When we can just be happy for somebody without saying, how does that affect me? Oh, I won, I lost. That's not what I wanted to happen. And it's not that you swallow that. It's that it's not part of the process anymore. And we can choose that. And that life sphere is where we're headed. And right now, it's hope that sustains us, that keeps us until we arrive at that ultimate destination. You know, talking about hope and eternity and all that kind of stuff, I got to admit that when I first gave my life to the Lord, eternity was the last thing I was thinking about. I wasn't worried about, if you died right now, do you know where you'd go? You know, because I was thinking, I'm in hell now. Who cares about, you know, dying might be a step in the right direction. I mean, that's kind of extreme, but you know, my life was completely in the dumper, completely in the dumper. For those of you that I haven't met yet, I am not church boy. I was not raised in the church. I didn't go to church. I knew nothing. You know, by the time I was 28 years old, I'd been married, and that marriage just crashed and burned. It was a nuclear explosion. It was a Holocaust, you know? I mean, it wasn't just over. It did a lot of damage, and I had no family because of all that, or in the process of all that. I was, you know, my mom, my sister, we were just kind of at a distance, and there was no real relationship there. Had no career, had a job, you know, but no career, no future, no prospects, no nothing really, and no hope that things were ever going to get better. I remember being about 30, and I told a friend of mine, I didn't expect to live past 35. I don't know if it was so much I didn't expect to. It really was I didn't want to. I figured, you know, when you're 28, 30, you think, well, 5 more years, I can kind of have some fun, do some stuff, and then I'll be ready to check out. Because it pretty much sucks. You know, hate to be so negative, but that's how it was. And my whole life, really, it was like waiting in a red light that never changes. Let's go already! And it just, and tick, 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 and the years go by, and the light's still red, and pretty soon you just say, well, I'll just park the car, forget it, I'm not going anywhere. And what I wanted, and what I needed from the Lord whenever that prospect opened up to me, what I wanted was help right here and right now. We can talk about eternity some other time, but I want some help right here, right now, and you know what? That's exactly what I got, was help. Here and now. He put my marriage back together. I didn't even ask him to. It wasn't something I've dreamed of or hoped for. He just did that. Reunited me with my family. He, Lord, called me into an occupation. It's not just a job, it's a passion of my life. You know, what he did was he changed that light from red to green. He said, okay, let's go. Step on it. Don't get a ticket. Let's go. Now, that's not none of that is to say that the struggle's over. Believe me, my life is not peaches and cream and easy street. Of course, mostly that's my own fault. But, you know, I'm not trying to paint some phony picture of nothing ever goes wrong again. In a lot of ways, really, the struggle has just begun for all of us as we live for the Lord, as we live as Christians. But now the difference is it's the hope of the glory, as it says in verse 18, that will be revealed in us, not to us, not for us, in us. And that hope, it comforts us as we struggle. It conforms us as we suffer. Turn back to Romans 5 and we'll close with this. These first couple of verses are Romans 5. Therefore, having been justified by faith, there's the theme of the book of Romans, having been set, placed in a right relationship with God because of faith, not because of anything about you, not because you deserve it, not because you earned it, not because you work for it or work at it, but justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom also we have access by faith into this grace, this unmerited favor, in which we stand and rejoice in the hope of the glory of God. And not only that, but we also glory in tribulations, knowing that tribulation produces perseverance, and perseverance character, and character hope. Now hope does not disappoint, because the love of God has been poured out in our hearts by the Holy Spirit who was given to us. Hope makes a difference, and hope does not disappoint. Do you have that hope? Do you have that kind of hope today, the hope of glory? I hope you do. I really do, and I hope it brings you rest. And if you don't have that hope, you can. You can. You qualify. It can be yours before you get up out of that seat you're sitting in right now. You can settle once and for all this morning whether the light on your life is a red light or a green light. And you can know where and with whom you'll spend eternity. And you can know the hope that makes this suffering of this life not only bearable, but relatively trivial, because it's that hope we have that makes that difference.